Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call. I'm in today for Rose Aguilar. Today marks 50 years since civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s life was cut short. He was staying at a hotel in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was there to support sanitation workers who were on strike for better wages and working conditions. He stepped out onto the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. He was hit in the neck by a single bullet from an assassin's gun. He was pronounced dead about 1 hour later. King is often remembered, of course, for that I Have a Dream speech, in which he imagined a world where people were not judged by the color of their skin. It's a wonderful philosophy, easy to agree with, of course, in principle. But we forget, we really never hear much about the facets of King's activism and the leadership as both a thought leader and as a provocateur, as an activist. Half a century after his killing, we're going to talk about today how we should understand the ideals that he strove for, but we're going to do that without sanitizing or whitewashing them. Decades after his passing, the society is a long way from making his many dreams a reality. And today we're going to talk about those philosophies and how remarkably unchanged America is in many ways 50 years later. So to delve into some of those questions with us today, we're joined in the studio by Ronald Sundstrom. He's a professor at the University of San Francisco. He teaches in the Philosophy, African American Studies, and Public Affairs programs. Thank you so much for being here, Professor Sundstrom.
Thank you.
Also in the studio is historian Candace Harrison. She is also director of the African American Studies program at the University of San Francisco. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Candace. Let's start by a quote today from a man who was on that balcony with Dr. King 1 year ago today. Reverend Jesse Jackson, the head of the Rainbow Push Coalition, said in a quote, "You know, they loved him as a martyr after he was killed, but they rejected him as a marcher. Love him as a martyr, hated him as a marcher." And it's true on some level, because he was absolutely vilified by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. A Gallup poll showed that he had a two-thirds disapproval rating. In many, many quarters, he was hated. Let's talk a bit about, starting with you, Ron, if we can, the extent to which he is venerated and sanctified now, but he was vilified then.
Yeah, we're very familiar with his veneration and his being raised up into the political pantheon that we have in the United States, both on the left and the right. We know all about the, you know, every February he's trotted out, and we get to hear about the dream. We get to see scenes from the March on Washington, sometimes disturbingly selling things. Mm-hmm. And we hear from the right as well, selected pieces from that speech, especially concerning content of character, distorted for their own, of course, political programs. Mm-hmm. So he's venerated and put to particular use by various political factions in our society, without totally appreciating his complexity and the depth and the breadth of his thought. And, of course, the difficulties that he faced while he was alive and the controversy that he generated in the basic activity of trying to secure civil rights for black people in the United States, the right to sit at a counter, to have lunch, to go and use a washroom, to sit anywhere you'd like on a bus or public transportation, to be, in fact, just to be recognized as a decent human being.
And it seems so simple now, but Candace Harrison, it was revolutionary then. And I'm always shocked when we get to this time of year, whether it's on the MLK birthday, when you pretty much see mattress sales at the local retailer.
That's right.
We've reduced it to that. But this man had a philosophy that was considered by a lot of people to be absolutely dangerous. What was so dangerous about his philosophy?
Everything was dangerous about Dr. King's philosophy. Even the practice of nonviolence and the act of marching, right, which you mentioned at the outset, was incredibly dangerous because that was about black people taking up public space. And historically, black people shouldn't be out, right, in public space by themselves. That was a deeply political act. It was incredibly threatening. It's still incredibly threatening today, right? And you see that with the wave of young people's movements in particular, drawing lots of attention and lots of criticism there. But in terms of, you know, Martin Luther King Jr.'s politics, by 1968, he had himself taken a more radical turn, right? He had come out very strong against the Vietnam War, against war in general. He was coming out strong, frankly, with criticisms of capitalism without necessarily, right, articulating those problems. But what he was focused on was poverty in the United States and really rooting out, the continuation of these economic disparities across the country. He believed that you could not eradicate racism without eradicating poverty. Mm-hmm. And so he came out strong in favor of unions. That's precisely why he was there in Memphis in 1968. Right, lending his support, lending his visibility, his public presence to those 1,300 black men primarily who were striking, right, mm-hmm. for higher wages and better benefits overall.
Absolutely.
It seems striking that no one had, or, you know, perhaps they had, but certainly not at this level of visibility, connected those dots. Capitalism, labor, poverty, race, mm-hmm. war, militarism. It seems like a natural, doesn't it? So I'm just, did he pull a page from anyone's book? Or was this original thought on his part, Ron?
Well, I don't like reducing King to one or another figure. But he definitely synthesized a lot of different things that were on the ground. And I'm learning often on the go. So from his theological studies, from Christian realism, from the social gospel, which had a huge impact on him as a young man, both of those things, as well as from neo and anti-colonial struggles against neocolonialism across the globe. He certainly took a lot of inspiration from the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, against colonialism, the lingering effects of colonialism in India. He was very much, you know, a student of history and of global politics, while taking seriously his theological and his philosophical commitments as a scholar of those subjects.
I'm sure that it landed with a thud in many quarters when Dr. King began to quote the American Constitution,
sure.
the U.S. Constitution, and quoting it back to his critics. In other words, saying, we are cashing the check that you issued. These are your words. Are you going to live up to them or not? Candace, how much of a challenge was it when he actually used the U.S. Constitution as the basis for this movement?
It was an incredible challenge, obviously. It's holding the nation accountable, right, by using its absolute framing documents. That's not particularly new. It's why historians refer to the civil rights era as the Second Reconstruction, right? Mm-hmm. You saw the same thing happening from black leaders, from Frederick Douglass, right, before emancipation. Du Bois, right, did a similar thing. And so our founding documents, the glory of the ideals embedded in both the Declaration of Independence and the rights, right, embedded in the Constitution, have been used historically by black leaders over and over and over again to draw the nation's attention back. Will they actually sort of step into the light and fully embrace those doctrines, those ideals, or will they continue to turn a blind eye? So he pulled on a very long political tradition of doing precisely that. Mm-hmm.
I want to invite our listeners to give us a call. This is one of those days where kids who are not out of school for a spring break may be talking about this date in history. And at coffee shops, people are just in general marking this 50th anniversary. And we'd like to know what parts of the King philosophy you think have been allowed to perhaps fade over time or maybe even been twisted in the decades since his passing. And how do you think that King's activism is shaping the way we're discussing the issues of race and poverty and war today? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. TALK. You can send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. We're talking in studio today with Ronald Sundstrom, professor at USF. He teaches philosophy, African American studies, and public affairs. Also in studio is Candace Harrison, director of the African American Studies Program at the University of San Francisco. It was just exactly, and I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing that you wouldn't believe it if it just hadn't actually happened, but it was exactly 1 year before his assassination on April 4th, 1967. On that date is when he went to New York's Riverside Church and delivered that speech, Beyond Vietnam, that has, in many people's minds, which made him turn the corner, which made the NAACP disavow him, which made the board of his own, SCLC, say, you're on your own. But in that speech, he made a shift and saying, "It's my message and ministry is not just about desegregation, but a broader engagement about pacifism and social and economic justice." Exactly 1 year later, he said, "I've come to a house of worship because my conscience leaves me no choice, and a time comes when silence is betrayal." And when he took that turn into international policy, he faced so many headwinds, both from inside and outside, from the left and the right. Do you reckon that he saw that coming? Would this philosophy almost automatically, Ron, do you think, have led to the push and pull that he received from both sides?
Oh, absolutely. There was cosmopolitan content, you know, in all of his thought from early on. I mean, he thought about the world, and not just America, not just about black people, but about the world and its interactions, its connections, thus driving his moral outrage and his demands for civil rights in the United States. So this was always there, and he thought hard about his position on Vietnam, and it troubled him. You see it, for example, his thoughts about his coming to grips with this in the book The Trumpet of Conscience, which he published in 67. He knew that this would be thought of as a diversion, as a diversion away from the movement if he got into it. But he said, no. I mean, we need to be perplexed about this war. We need to think about this in a complicated fashion. We can't just be, you know, easily for it or easily against it. But we should know its effects on our nation and in Vietnam. He was really upset about how the money for the war diverted from the poverty program and taking care of the poor here in the United States. And he was morally outraged how the sons of the poor here in the United States, who did not have full civil rights, were being sent abroad to kill, right, the Vietnamese people who are trying to struggle against, you know, to try to break free from their colonial domination, first by France and then by the United States seeking to secure the colonial grip over Vietnam. He said explicitly that it would have been hypocritical for him to promote nonviolence in the United States and not to oppose the violence that was happening in Vietnam and the war crimes that in particular that he saw and witnessed with the rest of Americans during that period. For him, and he said this really clearly in the Trumpet of Conscience, justice is indivisible.
Candace, the King Center actually addresses what he called the triple evils of poverty, racism, and militarism. And he considered all of those to be forms of violence that exist in a vicious cycle. So what about this approach was so controversial? And are we even at a point, even now, 50 years after his death, where we have come to accept these concerns as being interlocking, or are they still being driven apart in people's thinking?
That's a wonderful question and a tremendous question as well. I mean, when you think about the historic context of 1967 and 1968, you're talking about a country that is fully embedded in these capitalist ideals. And I just want to highlight that for just a second. You know, we, at that point, you know, we're engaging in Vietnam because of those ideals, right? And so we are fighting against a communist threat there. And so anybody who criticized that war in Vietnam was mm-hmm. not just making a statement against war, right, and for nonviolence. They were then, right, incidentally, right, also mm-hmm. making a criticism of our fight against communism and thus of capitalism of itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, King at that moment was towing a line. Let's be frank. He was towing a line all the way through his leadership in the civil rights mm-hmm. movement. That movement, although it was unified in the struggle for black uplift and for civil mm-hmm. rights, was actually deeply divided in terms of political strategies. And so young people who were a vital part of that movement, and I never want to forget them in this process, mm-hmm. Those young people were already very clearly advocating against the Vietnam War and our participation in that. In part, that's because they were the ones that were being sent potentially to war, mm-hmm. right, to die in that war. And so they were already asking these questions. King had to make a choice, right? Does he side with this older generation? Does he side with a more conservative, mm-hmm. frankly, right, legally mm-hmm. conscious NAACP who had been wounded through the years mm-hmm. when they approached, right, criticism of communism, for example, criticism of capitalism, for example, too? So when he finally made that choice to link all these issues together, right, he was in part trying to link the movement, right, in totality, but it was an incredibly risky decision because of life in 1968.
Mm-hmm. James Bevel, I don't know if that name rings a bell, but there were those like James Bevel. He was a preacher from Mississippi, very fiery, and he saw that King was being pushed toward creating Vietnam as an extension of the desegregation work mm-hmm. in the U.S., and he saw that as an extension of oppression. So, but ironically, after King's death, Bevel became a supporter of Ronald Reagan and actually became a running mate of Lyndon LaRouche. So these issues have moved like waves over time in history where people came down on the side of talk about domestic issues and desegregation mm-hmm. only. Don't veer into mm-hmm. international politics. And for God's sake, don't talk about capitalism. Mm-hmm. Let's keep it confined to this. Mm-hmm. And it's gone back and forth over time. If you had to identify where you think it is right about now, Ron, what are your thoughts about the extent to which these dots are connected?
Well, it's a very large question, and to echo Candace, it's a tremendous question. I think that the dots are connected in something that you mentioned earlier, and his tactics. He believed in a dangerous unselfishness that extended itself through the community and into the world. He's not against the market. He's not against buying and selling and owning necessarily, but he is against the exploitation of the people, the exploitation of the workers, and of us, and of a world gone money mad without thinking about, you know, what do we need to do to take care of the people around us, and not just in around us in an isolated, you know, America first way, but in a way that demanded a radical love, a radical unselfishness that made us think, what are we doing to people abroad? Right, and who are we using here in our country to do this to the people abroad? Mm. And are we making the world a better place, a safer place, or not? Right, let's spend our resources in uplifting the poor in the United States, of desegregation, of integration, and of bringing justice here. And in doing so, also work to bring justice abroad. It's a beautiful internationalist vision that was consistent thoroughly, and that's why I see the connection of the dots. That's where I see the dots connected. Certainly, his domestic audience were divided, though, over his mm-hmm. tactics, and painfully so. And he, though, did not back down, as Candace said. Yeah.
You know, I think it's extraordinary that he was able to enjoin the people who were resistant, mm-hmm. and yet able to, without having the benefit of social media mm-hmm. and instantaneous information, kind of bring a whole planet together mm-hmm. under the banner of this philosophy. Let's go to the phones. 866-798-8255 is the number. We're going to talk to Greg in San Francisco. Hi, Greg.
Hi. My comment is one of the things that has been lost in over the 50 years is the power of the pocketbook. I mean, you talked a little bit about it, but we've forgotten kind of how important the boycotts were and just how we spend our everyday dollar. If people knew that, you know, like the you know, Coors Beer supports right-wing politics, and so do the owners of Snapple, and people would spend differently. So that's my comment.
Great comment, actually, and it kind of brings us forward to today, right, when the young man, Mr. Hogg, which I have come to call him, I think he is well beyond his years,
yes,
the young Parkland, Florida student who determined that once Laura Ingraham of Fox News came at him because he was not accepted at some of his college choices, his response was, well, first of all, I wasn't whining, Laura Ingraham, but I'll tell you what, here's a list of 15 of your advertisers, and for all of my followers on social media, pick one and don't shop here and tell them why you're not shopping
Absolutely.
There. And within 24 hours, he had an apology, and suddenly Ms. Ingraham is on vacation. So talk about, Candace, if you would, the history of the boycott as part of making change, forcing change.
Yeah, I mean, that was such a tremendously significant aspect of, obviously, the Montgomery campaign in 1954. These economic boycotts, as Greg, you know, just mentioned, were seen as really an opportunity for everyday folks to demonstrate to the nation the power of the pocketbook, but also the power of black poor, right, truly poor communities overall. And so they did wind up making an incredibly effective statement overall. Moving forward, I have loved living in this present moment and seeing young people, right, take that strategy on as well. And it has been incredibly effective, right, so far. You're seeing companies who are selling certain products, right, certain types of guns, et cetera, now being, right, sort of stranded out in public, right, pulling different resources in terms of advertisers. So it continues to be effective. I think we need absolutely more of that. I also want to just point out how important boycotting was to Cesar Chavez, right, with the Great Boycott. Mm-hmm. So similar in using the strategies of both nonviolence, Christian theology, right, and these economic boycotts as central pillars.
Absolutely.
And deeply effective as well.
Yeah.
Ron?
Yeah, and one of my favorite and underread essays of his is called The Showdown for Nonviolence. He speaks directly about the power of the pocketbook and says to the congregations that listen to his speech, look, you know, you show up at the shop, you show up at the store, and you say, these are our values, and this is the service and the treatment we want, and if you can't give us this service, we're going to take our money elsewhere, and then turn on your heels and leave. And so what I loved about that strategy, it was very focused on particular targets, and it was driven by a particular and beautiful moral vision. So it was focused, much like the current movement we see around the March for Our Lives, and as you mentioned, the run-in between Mr. Hogg and Ingraham, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was very focused, rather than broad and amorphous. And the more that it is connected to a moral vision, the more effective that strategy is.
And everybody can participate.
Everyone can participate.
It's universal.
Yeah.
And very, very effective.
Mm-hmm.
And can I add one more thing?
Sure.
I think when you think about the efficacy of boycotts, mm-hmm. I think even for King at that moment and these early, you know, organizing mm-hmm. strategies, they weren't so concerned about really the economic impact of the companies that they were boycotting.
Right.
What the real mission of that was mm-hmm. was getting everyday folks to yes. recognize their own power,
yes.
right? And at a moment in which you'd had, right, historically black folks whose backs had been broken under the weight of slavery mm-hmm. and thus Jim Crow, right, in its mm-hmm. aftermath, it was so important for farmers,
yes.
for maids, right, for domestic workers, for sanitation workers mm-hmm. to feel powerful themselves. And so even if withholding 5 cents from that bus, right, mm-hmm. Help them to feel strong again, right? Mm-hmm. That's what Dr. King, that's what those organizers, Rosa Parks, right? That's what they were absolutely after.
Yes.
And it works still today, right? You can
right.
still withhold $5, right, from that mm-hmm. from that lunch spot, mm-hmm. And you feel like you are active in the movement.
Right.
And that is precisely the kind of small everyday acts mm-hmm. that actually launches and sustains movements.
That's absolutely right. The nickels and dimes add up, and not mm-hmm. necessarily to the losses for the business, but in the building of willpower and of solidarity for the groups involved.
Today we're talking about the less explored elements of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. 50 years after his assassination, we're talking with Ronald Sundstrom, professor of philosophy at the University of San Francisco, and Candace Harrison, director of the African American Studies Program at the University of San Francisco. We hope you'll join us. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today we're marking the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. We're discussing his legacy in a modern context. And we're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Speaking of which, tomorrow the labor issues in Bay Area restaurants. That's what we're going to be talking about. Would you decide where to eat based on how the staff there are treated? That's tomorrow on Your Call. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. Today, we'd love to hear from you about today's program, a discussion of Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy 50 years after his assassination. What parts of the King philosophy do you think have faded over time or even been twisted? And how does his activism shape the way you think about race, poverty, and war today? 866-798-8255 is the number. We have Phil in San Francisco who's waiting to talk to us. Thanks for waiting, Phil. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's an honor. Okay. I will be 70 this year, and then to realize that, well, this is a half century, folks. And I think off the top, I'm so glad that the country, and I don't know which president signed the authorization for Martin Luther King's birthday to be a national holiday, but I think what I learned this morning was the fact that it's so important to celebrate the life and to look at the lives of the individuals that we're focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
There's 9/11, they found a poster wall of people that perished, and it was about the life of that person, not just the memorialization of the footprint of the towers. And when we look at the disparity in wealth, the fact that we had President Carter on the show talking about the 8 wealthiest people having half the world's assets, this disparity, I mean, how are we going to change this? And I think my final comment is, I think together and with education and with effort toward everything from national public radio to speaking out and then boycotting. I know that by learning, okay, I'll leave it at this,
mm-hmm.
by learning from your show that the halos and the whole thing behind those little mandarins, I bought my first bag of cuties just because I knew halos belonged to water-robbing billionaires.
Well, being selective in your... thanks a lot, Phil. Thanks for calling in. The idea that politics and economics and racial issues and equality can all merge, for a lot of people, including Phil, who's 70, who was, what, 20 years old at the time, it struck a chord because somehow labor and equality movements have always been in tandem. And it's, I don't think, coincidental that King was in Memphis to support a sanitation workers' strike. In other words, at a moment when he was participating in a labor movement. And labor is still fighting for a living to this day. According to the Economic Policy Institute, between 1979 and 2013, the hourly wages of middle-wage workers were stagnant. They've only risen 6% in all those years, so something like 0.2% per year. And we know that teachers are protesting across the country for better wages. So how has King's leadership, do you think, Candace, impacted the modern American worker movement?
Well, you know, if you look at even what happens with the growth of unions for public employees right in the aftermath of the Memphis sanitation strike, their rights, right, to actually organize, to form unions, teachers, for example, start to dramatically increase. And so prior to that moment, you had a longer history of private labor unions in the country. So just that one sanitation strike, right, winds up having a tremendous effect, and certainly King's presence there helped overall. But, you know, I want to say a little bit about the reason, again, the historical context for why King began to embrace labor union organizing in particular, mm-hmm. and its clear linkages to the issue of racism in the United States. Primarily, I am a labor historian, and when you look at the history of labor unions, even the growth of the working class in the United States, that was a movement, a class consciousness that was absolutely tied to both whiteness and to masculinity. So from the very beginning, right, when you had these early trade unions in the United States in the early 19th century, you had a situation in which you had women, right, certainly women of color, but white women as well, and you had black folks who were absolutely excluded from those unions. That continued, that exclusion continued throughout the majority of our history as a nation. Mm-hmm. And so black people were left out of that union organizing process, which was why historically their wages had been so depressed, right, over mm-hmm. time. And indeed, the construction of a particular kind of white working class consciousness in the United States is what was connected to its supported white supremacy overall, right? Mm-hmm. The only thing that held together wealthy white folks and poor white folks was their whiteness, mm. right? Mm. So you can't disentangle, as he knew, right, race from labor and race from labor union organizing. Mm-hmm. So you had a situation, again, in Memphis in 68, you had a situation which approximately 80-some percent, right, of that population, that black population, was living below the poverty line. Nationally, you had a situation which just under 13% of the country was living below the poverty line. Mm-hmm. You know, what's our poverty point today? It's about the same. Mm-hmm. We're at 12.7%. As of the last national study. Mm-hmm. So this is a problem that persists despite the fact that we are one of the wealthiest nations in the world, one of the most highly educated, right, nations in the world as well, and we can't seem to figure it out, right? That's ridiculous. Yeah. And Dr. King would have thought that to be ridiculous too.
And isn't it something that, you know, because race is a false construct, because we keep getting distracted by that thing, that mm-hmm. race thing, it makes it that much more difficult for people to look past that and see that we are the 99%, that is where the commonality is, that workers and people of color and immigrants, that the one thing we all have in common is that human thing. And we can coalesce around that. But I guess I'm shocked, Ron, because we keep getting stuck on the race speed bump. even now, 50 years later, and, you know, when the 99% thing was happening, I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, we finally figured it out, that it's not about race, that we have a lot more in common. But that race thing keeps coming back, and under the Trump administration, it's being exacerbated. Yes. Does that surprise you at all, that 50 years on, we still get stuck on that?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. It's a part of the founding of this country and the legacy of this nation. And it's one of the reasons that class politics hasn't been able to really settle and take hold in the United States, because we're easily divided. And we not only seek to, you know, put the poor under our thumb, we constantly throughout our history have sought to keep the poor people of color in particular out of under our thumb, and poor foreigners under our thumbs. We've this has been a constant theme throughout American history. And I really don't think until the passage of the Civil Rights Act, in fact, this country was a democracy. It was a racial state where we were choosing over and over again through our laws, through our policies, to be a segregated country, to deny people of color, in particular blacks, Latinos, Native Americans, from full access to the opportunities of this nation. And it was only until the Civil Rights Act that we started loosening up on those strictures and allowing the world into our border, which we are currently experiencing a backlash with our current president, who embodies the exact opposite kind of leadership that you just spoke to in relationship to King, right? If King said, what we need to be is dangerously unselfish. What we see around us is a dangerous selfishness, right? This is not, his dangerous unselfishness was not just a call for a kind of Christian community, though it certainly was, and for citizenship, but also for a kind of leadership that put the poor forward, put the poor first, and understood our inclination to go astray and seek out our own personal or group benefit.
And you just published an essay recently called To Shape a New World, and it specifically combats the idea that King advocated for color blindness or a lack of awareness about race. And it occurs to me that 50 years hence, that there is a rip in our social fabric that a Donald Trump or someone like him could stick his finger in and really rip it open.
Oh, absolutely.
That the tear was already there.
Yes, absolutely. My essay is on the prophetic tension between King's race consciousness and the idea of color blindness, which we often put on King, though he was very reluctant to take on. The volume's called To Shape a New World, Essays on the Political Philosophy of Martin Luther King Jr., edited by wonderful scholars Tommy Shelby and Brandon Terry at Harvard. So I'm really happy to be part of that volume. It brings together a collection of people who really explore, you know, what is his theological, his political, his historical, and his philosophical legacy for us.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we are talking about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy on the 50th anniversary of his assassination. And here with us in studio is historian Candace Harrison, director of the African American Studies Program at the University of San Francisco, and Ronald Sundstrom, professor at the University of San Francisco, teaching philosophy, public affairs, and African American studies. You're welcome to join us, 866-798-8255, or drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. You know, I was amazed when I was reading some of Dr. King's writings in which he embraced the idea that he was an extremist. And we hear that word bandied about a lot today. But he wrote, quote, "So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love?" Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, Candace, what you think are the parallels to his labeling of activists as extremist when you look at movements today?
Yeah, I mean, the quote that you just read is from his letter from a Birmingham jail, right? I mean, let's remember that moment. Let's remember that this is a man who was sitting in the jail cell handwriting this letter on pieces of napkins, mm-hmm. right, that were smuggled in by his attorney, Clarence Jones, mm-hmm. without any books, right? So if you go back and read it, I want everybody to read it from that context, right? So this is a brilliant, brilliant individual. Mm-hmm. And he was absolutely at a point, right, of frustration with white ministers there in Birmingham who were telling him, right, to go slow, mm-hmm. telling all people who were advocating for civil rights to go slow. And he said, this is ridiculous, right? There's nothing extreme about what I'm doing except, right, in my vision that truly love, right, can mm-hmm. lay at the foundation of our society. And if we shed light on that, right, we will then usher justice into society. These young people today, you know, I'm so terrible with names, so forgive me. But, you know, these young leaders, the young woman who's coming out of Parkland in particular, who's mm-hmm. been just shredded, right, by her opposition. Mm-hmm. And it's despicable, right, mm-hmm. overall, especially, right, to target young people in this way.
Yeah.
She is the very best kind of extremist, and I think Dr. King would be so incredibly proud of these young people.
You think?
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think he would say
yeah.
in response to that march that we saw a couple of weekends ago?
Right on.
Exactly. I think he would be given the stage over to the young and cheering them on. I mean, they embody as do several current political women. You know, his ideas of a nonviolent confrontation that creates a creative tension. That's exactly what he talked about in the letter for Birmingham Jail, which was in fact, right, Candace, I believe, written for a white evangelical audience,
yes.
right? The ministers who told
yes.
him to moderate his approach and get out of the streets of Birmingham,
yes.
right? So the fact that these kids are waking us up, including those of us who are moderate, saying, look, you know, we're dying. You need to protect us. And you need to bring some sensible gun laws and to our schools, to our streets, and to our country. He would have been absolutely in favor of them.
And there's so many images out there in the modern mm-hmm. day protests where kids in the streets are hurling things at windows and mm-hmm. turning over trash cans. And that imagery mm-hmm. In some people's minds is undermining. And yet, Dr. King himself spoke about the fact that violence sometimes spills over and erupts in the human spirit. In Memphis, he went to a march that started late. It quickly turned ugly. There was mm-hmm. looting. Cops were injured. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of people were arrested. By the time he got back to his hotel room, he was just remorseful. Mm-hmm. And he said, quote, maybe we just have to admit that the day of violence is here. And maybe we have to give up and let violence take its course. So I'm just wondering, when you see that there are elements of the movement, whether it's anarchists or others, who become part of the movement, that violence has its own energy and sometimes gets the attention that pacifism doesn't. Is there a role for that kind of high-profile participation in this movement?
Yeah, I'm interested.
I know it's provocative.
Yeah, Candace.
I know. Is there any room at all for getting attention one way or the other?
Yeah, I've got a lot to say about this, but I'd like to hear.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, too, that there was a 16-year-old mm-hmm. boy that was shot during that march in Memphis,
yes.
too.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't want to not remember him. Mm-hmm. And again, the role of college students,
right.
Black and white, that
right.
were there, and high school students who walked out, actually, to join those sanitation
yes.
workers in support in 1968. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're asking me personally, politically, do I think that there's a role for violence?
Yeah.
You know, I think I'm certainly not an advocate of violence myself. I would not employ it as any type of political strategy, but I most definitely understand it. It is the boiling up of frustrations mm-hmm. of a people who have experienced acts of violence committed against them for centuries in this country. And you know, in certain situations, you know, their logic makes sense that if you're going to fight back and be successful, then you defend yourselves and you defend yourselves by any means. Mm-hmm. In terms of what it does to movements, it's tricky, mm-hmm. right, because of the media mm-hmm. and the way that media spins violence,
Absolutely.
Any kind of violence. It mm-hmm. could just be an act of self-defense, mm-hmm. but suddenly, right, it becomes particularly threatening, especially if that violence is inflicted by people who are either poor, right, or mm-hmm. black or brown.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think the media can play a tremendous role, really, in shifting the narrative around violence
Absolutely.
And its purpose, and I wish that they would do more.
So maybe
that.
More than violence even, maybe disruption. That's, I guess, what I'm referring to more than violence. No
yeah.
one wants to advocate for violence. But even most recently in Sacramento, you know, shutting down the Sacramento Kings basketball mm-hmm. game, mm-hmm. Shutting down highways. In Memphis, there was a demonstration in mm-hmm. which they blocked access to stores. And one of the organizers, a young guy, Kedron Franklin, is a well-known Memphis organizer. He said, tell you what, we're shutting down the retailers because our motto is, if we can't make money, y'all can't make money either. Our intention is to stop money. So if we did it smiling or we did it angry, we still did what we needed to do.
Yeah.
So that seems to be a really important part of modern movements, that kind of disruption, unapologetic disruption. Ron, what do you think is the role of that?
Yeah, it's a very complex question. I think disruption definitely is part of the role of protest, and that's what King talked about when he discussed creative tension. But he was also very aware of tactics and strategies and appealing to the larger public to engage in moral suasion. In that piece that I mentioned earlier, Showdown for Nonviolence, he mentions that in relationship to economic power, that we don't need bricks and Molotovs. What we need is to use the power of our pocketbooks. But I completely agree with Candace that he had a lot of sympathy for when the community boiled over, when people just had enough. And that's what I see a lot in his writings when he addresses violence. One of my favorite pieces is the Black Power chapter from his last book, Where Do We Go From Here? It's a beautiful chapter. And in that, he addresses the nascent Black Power movement and its birth in Greenwood, Mississippi. I mean, it was born in more than just Oakland. It was born in Greenwood as well. And addressed Stokely Carmichael's leadership. So he was... He understood its source, he understood its power, its appeal, but also he was very aware of its limitations. I'm not going to, you know, say he was always against it. He was generally sympathetic with young people and worried about it spilling over, but he was also aware about its use of strategy. However, I think he would actually criticize the Antifa movement and the anarchists who join in these movements and then peel away at late at night and use their bricks and their Molotovs, because those groups don't necessarily discuss the interests and the needs of the community with the community. They're often pursuing their own agenda. And what the King's kind of leadership represents is a leadership of solidarity, of a movement of solidarity, and those groups' tactics, when they insert themselves into a larger movement, are not necessarily in dialogue with those original movements.
You know, you touched on, too, Ron, the evangelical, white evangelicals
yes, yeah.
who
right.
were very concerned about his disruptive, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, disruptive yeah. behavior. Talk about saving the soul of America, which yeah. is what he said was his goal. Candace, the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, had as part of their founding principles to save the soul of America. Is it savable? To what extent has it been saved? In the last 50 geez. Years, I know.
You know, I mean, that soul is in flux, too, and we need to be mindful of that. You know, we change a great deal as a people over time. So, you know, yeah, I don't know. Ron, you might have to take this one. We obviously have a long way to go, mm-hmm. and part of the problem is that our soul has been in flux because... We have dealt since King's assassination with problems I don't think he could have foreseen.
Yeah.
Right? Such as?
He talked a lot about automation, for example, towards the end. He was very concerned about that and its impact on wage work, right, and service work, manual service in the country, manual work, excuse me. He, I don't think, really saw this process of deindustrialization and its potential effects playing out long term. Mm-hmm. He would not, I think, have been able to imagine the influx of drugs into this country and the war on drugs and mass incarceration, right? I mean, this, we are now so steeped in a set of not particularly new problems, but new faces put on old systemic inequalities in the country that, you know, our soul has changed. Now we have to reckon with a lot more. Our military is even larger, right, than it was at that moment. We are involved in more wars than he probably would have imagined this moment to. Vietnam was just sort of the tipping point for what we would go on to be involved in. So, no, our soul is not saved, but I believe in it, right? I still do, and that is part of the great legacy of Dr. King, is that hope of transformation.
That's right.
And with just a minute or two left, that speech where he said, I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Yes.
As we wrap up, Ron, how close are we? How far away are we?
We need to institute his Bill of Rights for the working class and the poor. I think we're very far away from that vision into the promised land. It's not an impossible place to get to, but it's going to require a heck of a lot of work and the right kind of leadership and the commitment to the least of these. He believed in a soul, most certainly the metaphysical kind of soul. He most certainly believed in the soul. But he spoke to those of us who don't necessarily believe in the soul. He spoke to all of us, and he calls us together for moral leadership, and to understand our collective power, but also our collective ability to go astray. His favorite book is Reinhold Niebuhr's Moral Man in the Immoral Society, and that was the warning of that book. And it's something that you see in King's ideas all the time. Alone, we are wonderful, but together we have a tendency to be twisted, and we need to work together to resist that.
I want to thank Ronald Sundstrom. Thank you for your thoughts today on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. Ronald Sundstrom, professor at USF, and Candace Harrison, also a USF professor of history. Thank you for your calls today. Our producer is Laura Wienis today, and Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. I'm Renee Kemp. Thanks for joining us. This is Your Call.